horticulturists do more than answer questions on the radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day today, and in the next hour, we're going to explore what horticulture is really all about. Jeff Iles is the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. We'll talk about what kind of research is done in the department, how it supports farmers and gardeners in Iowa, and what it has to offer students. We'll also talk about how the department is changing to keep up with the times. ISU Extension horticulturist Linda Nave will also be here, and she and Jeff will answer your questions about your yard and your garden. Join the conversation by calling 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear from you after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me is Jeff Iles. He's the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. And in a few minutes, ISU Extension horticulturist Linda Nave will join us. And Jeff, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Welcome back to the state of Iowa, Charity.
Thank you. It's been a long time since we've been on the air together.
It has been.
A while back, I was talking with Donald Lewis, who's often on this program, and I said, so what do you do with a degree in horticulture? And Donald said, well, you get your own radio show. So beyond having a rocket to a great radio career,
right,
what do you train students to do in the horticulture department at Iowa State?
Well, my parents used to ask the same question. What do you actually do? I mean, why do they pay you for this? And really, I have the best job in the state of Iowa, I think. We train students to do all kinds of things. Excuse me. Horticulture is one of those things that's kind of hard to wrap your arms around because we do so many things. But consider the fact that our graduates get involved in turf grass management. So they might work at an athletic complex, or they might work for a golf course. And we've had some students go on to work in some pretty amazing places. They might be involved in fruit and vegetable production. And as you know, that area is growing by leaps and bounds. And then, of course, they might work at nurseries, they might work at garden centers, tree care companies. And so our students are kind of spread out all over the spectrum and all over the country, and they have a good reputation. You know, the Iowa work ethic has a reputation, and our students have a great reputation. So it's amazing, though, the number of careers that are out there and the great word we hear about our students once they leave Iowa State.
How large is the department?
Well, right now we have about 160 undergraduate students. Our high watermark was back in about 2001. We were close to 300, and that was probably a bit too much for us to handle. So right now we're down to about 160. We'd like to see that go a little higher. We think that there's lots of potential for careers in horticulture, we're comfortable with that number right now.
And, of course, on this show, we often have professors from the horticulture department, and we also almost always have somebody from ISU Extension. What is the relationship of the horticulture department with Extension?
Well, I think it's hand in glove. I think for a long time we've thought of ourselves as being a very strong department on the Extension side. We connect with the people of Iowa, both the consumers and commercial folks. Excuse me. And I think it's extremely important. You know, we are a land-grant institution, and we firmly believe in the tripartite mission of teaching, research, and extension. So it's what we do, and it's part of my job, and it's probably one of the most favorite parts of my job is to get out in the field and talk to growers and people that are managing their landscapes. So we consider it part of the critical part of our mission, and boy, if we ever lose sight of that, then we're in trouble.
As part of a large research university, of course, you're doing research in the horticulture department. What kinds of research projects are going on?
And thanks for bringing that up, because I don't want to put that off to the side. Horticulture, of course, is a plant science, and we have graduate students, we have faculty that conduct research, and it, once again, it's across the spectrum of all the things that we do. We do applied research in the field where we look at better ways to grow these horticultural crops. We have basic researchers that are looking at things at the molecular level, and it really is across the board. So you can pick any of those crops and find somebody working in the field and in the lab trying to make these crops be stronger, grow better, and be appropriate for the state of Iowa.
Can you give me a specific example of a research project that's going on right now?
We have folks, let's just take the burgeoning wine and grape industry. And so we have faculty that are looking at appropriate cultivars to use of wine grapes to use in the state of Iowa. Remember that there's all kinds of grapes that are used to make wine. Not all of them are appropriate for the state of Iowa. Some of them don't perform very well because of our harsh winters. And so we have faculty that are looking at the best selections to use, the best ways to grow them, and of course, the best ones that make a pretty good tasting wine.
Do a lot of your research projects end up coming to a halt in the winter months? Do you have to focus just on the growing season?
No. In fact, when you live in the upper Midwest, winter hardiness is an important issue. And so back in the day when I did research, and boy, that was a long time ago, I would spend a lot of time in the field collecting samples during the winter because you want to see how well things are progressing. But no, research is a year-round thing. And of course, when you have greenhouse facilities like we did and like we will have, again, then you can conduct research at any time of the year in these controlled environments.
You mentioned the greenhouse facilities, and I know that you've gone through a teardown process and you're building new greenhouses at Iowa State. Why did you need to do that?
Well, if you've ever seen our old greenhouses, and old is an appropriate word, some of them date back, some of the ranges date back to 1913. That's old. It's even older than I am.
That's
so
older than when I like it. That's good.
And they were beginning to show their age, and so it was high time that we built new ones. The problem with the old greenhouses was that it was hard to control the environment. If you're going to be doing research in the summer, you need to be able to lower the temperatures, and it was awfully hard to do that in these very, very ancient structures. And so, yes, we embarked on a fundraising plan. This became a $4 million project, and we thank Iowa State and the College of Ag and Life Sciences for contributions. And then we went to our alums and our friends out there and raised the additional $1 million. Right now the greenhouses are being built. They should be up and ready to go by next summer, and it's just it's a great great day for our department.
What is a modern greenhouse like?
Well, it would have all the bells and whistles that a production greenhouse would like. Consider this, that we teach our students how to manage greenhouses. That's another thing that we do. And so we need to show our students modern facilities so they are able to go out in the workplace and fit right in. And so a modern greenhouse would be able to control the environment, regardless of the time of the year. It would provide there'd be some eye towards being a green greenhouse, if you will. These structures would be energy conservation structures. They wouldn't waste energy, and so they would provide a great environment for plants. They'd be safe to work in, and that's exactly what we're going to have.
When you say bells and whistles of a modern greenhouse, give me an example of a bell and a whistle.
Well. As you know, in the wintertime, heat escapes through these structures. And so these new greenhouses will have ways to conserve on the heat, to keep the heat from leaving. They'll also maximize light transmission. There'll be modern ways of irrigating plants. We hope to include some flood bench technology, which is another way of watering these plants from the bottom instead of from the top. We'll be able to inject carbon dioxide into the environment, into the atmosphere, which will enhance plant growth. But the biggest one for me is temperature control, because with that's critically important. You want to maintain plant-friendly temperatures regardless of the time of the year, and we'll be able to do that now with these new facilities.
You mentioned earlier that there's more and more interest in horticultural crops, growing or horticultural crops on farms. And give me, for people who don't know, what is a horticultural crop as opposed to, let's say, corn and soybeans?
An agronomic crop. Right. Well, we lay claim to all kinds of things. I mean, you name it, from raspberries and grapes to any fruit and vegetable you can think of. So things that you eat and things that you eat fresh produce are horticultural crops. And as you know, the interest in growing your own has just blossomed over the last couple of years. And so we're interested in helping consumers, Ma and Pa Iowa, and we're also interested in helping those people that make a living from growing these crops for local use. The words local foods have become almost trite, but boy, Google them anytime, and you'll see just what a large movement this is. And at Iowa State, and particularly in my department, we feel the need to support that effort. Because there are lots of folks that are interested in it. We think it's a good thing to eat fruits and vegetables, and it's great when you can support the local economy. And so toward that end, we are going to be hiring a couple new folks here. We have an extension field specialist we'll be hiring to help with our outreach mission, as we just talked about, And then we hope to hire a faculty person to be housed in my department to do some teaching, research, and extension. So we're responding to the need out there. And again, this is great news for Iowans and for the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State.
Jeff Iles is the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. And Linda Nave is also here with us. She's a horticulturist with ISU Extension. And Linda, of course, those kind of crops are one of your specialties as well.
That's right. I work Extension Value-Added Ag, and I am one of the ISU alums in the Horticulture Department. When he said reputation is good, I said, I put that aside. I am alum of Iowa State University Horticulture Department. Proud of that fact, and I think what they're doing over there is fabulous with the new greenhouses. So, and I work in Extension Value Added Ag program, and with that, we do a lot in agritourism, specialty crops, adding value to the produce. One thing that we have going right now this fall, and it's been ongoing, but I want to put an emphasis on it, is our agritourism industry. Right now is a perfect time to take your family or go to a visit to a farm. And there are many farms in the area, and you can look for that on our Value-Added Ag website, where those farms are located, how much they charge, what they have going. Could be a corn maze. It could be a pumpkin patch, an apple orchard, a berry patch to pick late raspberries, the U-Pick operations. And you can learn more about farming. You can learn more about farm equipment and really just have a good time, good family fun on the farm. So I would suggest people, if they're looking for something to do, just don't, you don't have to drive too far either to find a farm that has some agritourism going on.
So do you coach people on how to make corn mazes?
I don't personally, but I'm sure there's somebody around that does and encourages it. It's a lot of technology today that creates those corn mazes, a lot of creativity and technology.
All right. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can also send email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have any questions about your yard or your garden, Jeff and Linda will answer them, I promise. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And right now, I know that there are a number of things that we should or could be thinking about planting, and one of them is trees. What kind of a window do we have for planting new trees right now?
Right. I think fall planting, Charity, is a great thing for trees. The window is dependent upon how soon winter shows up at our doorstep, and we never, of course, know that. If you remember, 10, 15 years ago, we had -4 on Halloween night or right after that, and that's not good. But I look at the months of September and October as prime tree planting time, and so get out to the what makes it good is the soil conditions are usually conducive to planting. They're not overly wet like they might be in the spring. Sometimes you'll run into some pretty good tree sales this time of the year, too, and that's another reason to get out there and plant trees. So right now is a good time.
All right. The number to call if you have any questions, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guests today are Jeff Iles, the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, and ISU Extension horticulturist Linda Nave. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Horticulture Day today. With me, ISU Extension horticulturist Linda Nave and Jeff Iles, the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions about your yard and your garden. I want to return for just a moment to my question about planting trees this time of year. Are there any kinds of trees that you should avoid planting this time of year?
You know, I used to worry about that, but I planted some things that I probably shouldn't have, and I've got them to live. So I don't know. I guess I can't think of any, really. What's most important is to match the tree to the site. I see lots of trees being planted in poor sites, places where they don't belong, trees that are going to be too large for the site, or maybe we don't pay attention to their soil pH needs. But, you know, we used to worry about planting some shade trees in the fall. Perhaps magnolia was one, but But I don't know. I think if you do it right, then you can get by with it and have good success.
And it does tend to be a little drier this time of year. Do you have to be very careful about making sure they get enough water?
Well, that's an important part of post-plant care. Of course, you want to plant the tree at the right depth. You want to mulch and water appropriately. This time of the year, it's a little easier because we generally have dependable rains. But you're right. You can't plant something and then walk away and forget about it. So proper water management and then tapering that water off as we go into the latter part of fall is important. You don't want to overwater things.
If you have a question, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. First today, we have Jill on the line in Mason City. Hello, Jill.
Oh, good morning. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call. I have a problem with milkweed. And I know most people, you know, want to grow it or, you know, get it to grow someplace, but it's in my gardens. And I've tried to dig it up.
Okay, I'll take that one. Milkweed is an interesting plant because it's sometimes considered a weed in some species and because it's in the ditches and it's in the fields. But there are ornamental species of milkweed that are beautiful in a garden, and they have been adapted from some of our native species. Butterfly weed is one, which has that beautiful orange flower, dark orange to light orange to almost yellow, depending on the cultivar. They're wonderful to grow, but the problem is they're hard to dig to transplant out because they have a tuberous root, a root that swells in the soil, and if you don't get that and some of the feeder roots, you could have a problem. Because if you just dig that, if you've tried that, you know what I'm talking about. But you need additional root system for that. And take smaller divisions off of that plant. Don't go with the great big clump because you've got a lot of top foliage. And as far as transplanting, the best time to dig them and transplant them, divide them, would be in the spring.
Yeah, I don't want to transplant them. I want to get rid of them because, you know, and I've dug them up, and they're 30-foot roots.
Yes.
I've dug and dug and dug. And so I just want to get rid of them. I mean, is there some...
Okay, so you have the weedy species,
not the
ornamental species.
Okay, right.
The common weed, it is a perennial, as you know. It come back year after year with that. What I would do is I would spot treat with Roundup.
Okay.
Or glyphosate, because that's your best bet, because it's a non-selective herbicide. It will go down to the roots. It gets tied up in the soil, so it won't affect its neighbor plants. But be very careful. You could almost use a sponge applicator to put that Roundup on the foliage, and it doesn't need a lot. And this foliage is very broad, so it's not like you're going to miss it.
Right.
So I would just spot treat with Roundup, and I think you'll do a very good job with that. Now, if it comes up again next year, just hit it again, because if it's like a thistle, it's persistent too. So,
what time of year? Does it matter?
Yes, you want it during its active growth time. And right now it's sort of senescing, but I think you could have a pretty good kill this year, but it might come back, but a weakened version next spring, in which case I would hit it again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Jill. Next up, we have Jake in Iowa City, and I think we'll be able to take care of this one pretty quickly. Jake, what's your question?
I just have a quick question about compost. I've heard that you're not supposed to use compost on a garden if you've had, like, dog waste or animal waste in there, and I guess I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks a lot, Jake.
That's a good controversial question, and the reason we say that is because dog feces, animal feces that are carnivores, their feces contain and harbor certain bacteria and organisms that are not safe for people. So you don't want to use your compost pile or just dispose of your cat litter on your compost pile for that reason. It's a safety factor. If your compost bin runs properly and you get the temperatures up to 180 degrees or higher, 180, 190, though many of those organisms will be killed. But most home garden compost piles do not reach that temperature. And then if you reintroduce it into a vegetable garden, you're putting that right back, and if you grow root crops. So there are a lot of variables that have to take place in order for it not to be safe, but To err on the side of safety is probably better. So we do not recommend putting any kind of animal feces. So if you're using grass clippings, I would definitely get the pooper scooper out first and then mow the lawn and collect the grass clippings.
All right. Thank you for your call, Jake. Candace is on the line in Dubuque. Hello, Candace.
Hi. I have a lilac bush that always blooms in the spring, and I've noticed that the leaves are turning brown, and it looks like it's dying. But there are two blossoms on it that have the flowers, and they actually are more fragrant than they typically are in the spring. Hmm. And I can't explain it, and I was just curious if you knew what was causing that.
So what's causing the flowering this time of the year?
Pardon?
You're asking about the flowering this time of the year.
Yes, there's only two. And otherwise, it looks like it's dying.
Yeah. Well, it's been kind of a weird summer. Some of those leaves are probably senescing early. We had a lot of rain, but we've also had some dry weather here recently, and so perhaps the plant is going dormant earlier than normal. But the precocious flowering you're seeing is something we see on crabapple once in a while. We see it on magnolia. And the plants get confused. Keep in mind that the flower buds are set sometime in midsummer for the following spring. And so the flower buds are sitting there, and sometimes plants get fooled by a weird change in weather. And typically it's a stress followed by good conditions that cause the plant to get confused. And so if we have hot, dry weather followed by some cooler, wet weather, the plant sometimes gets confused, and then it throws a few flowers at us late in the year or at a weird time of the year. And that's what you're seeing now. It's not a big deal. I mean, you've lost two flowers you might have enjoyed next spring, but that's about the extent of the problem.
Okay, and what about the fact that they actually smell better than they... Normally, this bush, it doesn't...
Really?
There is not much of a fragrance to it.
Yeah,
but
that's a harder one.
Okay.
That's a harder one to explain. Now, maybe because there's no competing fragrances in the environment, maybe that's why they're more pronounced. But I don't know. I can't think of a scientific reason why the smell factor would be more enhanced this time of the year. That's a good one. But your smeller is more sensitive than mine, apparently.
Well, just enjoy them, Candace. Thanks so much for your call. Next up, we have John in Mason City. Hello, John.
Hello. I was just wondering, when is the best time to prune black raspberries?
Black raspberries, more than a double pruning. You want to prune them typically in the spring. However, after they've finished producing, you want to go in and get rid of all the canes that had the fruit on. Chances are they're dying back right now as it is. So go in and get rid of all the old canes that have produced. You can do that now or you could do that next spring. Depends when it's most convenient for you. And then as the plants grow, what you want to do is encourage the new primocanes that come up. But you don't want to get rid of the canes that are growing for this year. So you've got your primocanes and your canes that are producing the fruit. So in other words, you want to go in and get all the dead stuff out this fall. Next spring, you'll be thinning it out so your patch is a little bit more open because they grow in clumps. So I would definitely open up your patch next spring, prune the black raspberries back so that you get rid of the dead tissue on top, and then encourage new primocane growth, and that will be then pruned a little bit later in the season. We do have a publication on berries through the Extension Office. I think you can find it online on the Extension Online store on berry production.
Do you have to treat black raspberries differently than you do the red raspberries or the more domestic kind?
Yes, you do a little bit because of their growth pattern, their growth habit. You do. So this publication does spell it out very clearly, and it can be a little complicated to discuss over the radio, but the publication actually has very good diagrams as well.
All right, and we could find that at the ISU
Extension website, and then just go to store. And a lot of them now are on PDF files, so you just download them on your own.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, John. If you have a question, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have an email from Barry in Marion, and he says, I have maple, ash, and honey locust in my yard. Some need to be trimmed or pruned. Is now a good time to do this, or should I wait until early March?
With those species, Barry, I think you could do it now. I think if I had my preference, I'd wait until that late dormant season in March. Sometimes if you prune this time of the year, you might get some winter dieback where you've made some pruning cuts. But shoot, if you've got the time and if these are situations that need to be addressed right away, I would see no problem with doing it. You know, there's only a couple narrow windows where I wouldn't prune, and I've never known a tree to die because it was pruned in the wrong time of the year. The only exception to that would be oak. We like to only prune oak during the dormant season, but the three species you've mentioned you could probably get now if you've got the time.
He also wants to know what percentage of the tree could be pruned back.
Well, there's some general rules of thumb on a mature tree. I hate to take more than 20% at any one time, so if you can do that calculation, then that's the way to go. Generally, you look for flaws in the tree's architecture, branches that are rubbing or crossing or poorly attached, and you handle those. And if you do that, you generally aren't taking more than 20% anyway. But try not to go above that percentage.
And Jeff, when you were talking earlier about the lilac bush, you used the word senescing. Can you define that for us?
Well, it's this time of the year, of course, the leaves are reducing their function, so they're senescing, and eventually they're going to fall from the plant. So it's simply just a way that another term we use for the plant jettisoning those leaves that it doesn't need anymore, and so senescing and falling off are natural things that happen to plants that are deciduous in nature. Even evergreens do it. I mean, evergreens are called evergreens, but they don't hold on to all of their needles for eternity. So all plants go through this process. Al Shigo, who was one of the famous tree guys, he passed away a couple of years ago, but his famous line was that trees are shedding organisms. They're always shedding something, sometimes to their detriment, but they drop leaves, they drop branches, twigs, bark, you name it, and they're dropping. And that's kind of what they do. So they produce tissue, and then they shed tissue, and it's just part of the natural cycle, as they say.
And so senescing is what most of us in lay terms would call turning.
Turning, that's part of it. It's a dying. Maybe that's kind of a callous way to put it, but it's the end of the road for that particular a particular leaf.
All right, Lloyd is on the line from Nashua. Hello, Lloyd.
Good morning.
Hi,
Glenn and Linda. I was listening with interest to the opening comments about greenhouse redevelopment, if you will, at Iowa State. And that's both exciting and challenging in my thinking that I understand that greenhouses designed to allow research year-round may have implications for those of us trying to work with high tunnels. This morning I'm delivering produce from both high tunnel and greenhouse, as well as field. And could you speak, Glenn, to the relationship between greenhouse development and the time, the money, the management issues that are involved in high tunnels? I know, Linda, this is a topic close to you as well.
All right, Jeff.
Hopefully my question is focused enough there.
Yeah. You know, Lloyd, it's a great question. And I'm not sure I'm going to do it justice. High tunnels is a great new technology, and maybe it's not new anymore. I look at those as ways to extend the season on either end. You can kind of get things growing faster in the spring and maybe extend the season a bit into the fall. And the good thing about high tunnels is they're rather inexpensive compared to a greenhouse range. So greenhouses aren't a substitute by any means for high tunnels. In fact, high tunnels is a great revolutionary technology, and I see more and more people gravitating towards them. Mainly because of cost. And high tunnels can come in all different shapes and sizes. Some are rather large, others are lower profile, but there's great potential there for their use in the state of Iowa. You know, greenhouses are nice because we can control the environment to a much a greater degree than you might in a high tunnel. So for research purposes, they're fantastic, and we can you know, control their environment to a very calculated degree. There are some producers that produce food crops in greenhouses, and of course the expenses there are much larger. But they're usually working at an economy of scale where I guess they can pull that off. So I see the need for both. I guess, Lloyd, I'm not quite understanding maybe the concern. We're certainly not research done in greenhouses doesn't mean that we're not doing research in high tunnels as well. We have research going on there also. So we're trying to cover the waterfront.
Does that address your concern, Lloyd?
That's encouraging. There's a whole lot of emphasis on building high tunnels these days, and it's really, by my personal experience anyway, a huge challenge to manage, take on the management issues, inputs, pest, disease, irrigation, ventilation.
All right.
All these, and I'm looking for all the help I can get.
Right. Well, and your call is very...
That comes from Extension. I appreciate that.
And your call is very timely because that's why we employ folks like Linda Nave, and that's why we're going after these two new positions that I talked about at the beginning of the program. We know that there's a tremendous need to support growers like yourself. That is our mission, and so that's why we're really excited about adding these two new people to help Linda Nave in these areas. Dr. Tabor, who retired, left a pretty big hole when he did retire, and so that's another reason why we're trying to backfill into these important areas.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Lloyd. And Linda, I hope I would love to focus on one of our Hort Days in the near future on high tunnels, because I think that is certainly a growing part of even home gardening for some people, as well as in production of fruits and vegetables. So I hope we can do
that. Yeah. Yes, I'd be glad to do that. There is a lot of interest. We had a high tunnel on display with the NRCS Boone County Soil and Water Conservation Service over there, and people had, of all venues, professions stopped by. Some wanted it for a backyard garden for their own use, for berry production or vegetable production, and others were really interested in it as a side income or for production for an individual who's coming back to the farm and the family farm and wants to do a little more income in that direction. So a lot of interest out there.
All right. Well, I hope we can explore that in the near future. And whatever you're looking to explore, give us a call, 866-780-9100. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Friday, Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. And with me today are Jeff Iles, the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University, and ISU Extension horticulturist Linda Nave. And if you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have an email from Dell in Cedar Falls. He said that he heard the conversation earlier about animal waste, dog and cat, or carnivore waste in the compost and the garden. What about herbivore waste, horse and cattle? Is that safe to use in the compost?
That is safer. Some people use their little bunny droppings in the compost pile. Typically, that feces breaks down. It's got plant debris in it as well. If you don't use it as entirely, if you don't use it hot, so to speak, in other words, they're full of salts, and you want to totally break it down. So some people apply it a little too early. They compost their horse bedding, and it works great in the garden. They compost some animal manure, but it's in moderation because you do need that carbon source as well as a nitrogen source. But if you apply it too fresh or don't totally compost it, you've got problems.
Okay, and of course you can buy composted manure.
You can.
At any garden center.
Yep. Yep, so just the idea is to process it properly, and it is really a good product in the end.
All right, Dell had one more question. He says he has a lone Jonathan tree, an apple tree, with what looks like a pretty good yield this year, and he understands that there are some apples that should be harvested after a frost. Is that true? Should he wait?
No. Depending on the variety, they need, as soon as that apple is ready and it starts to fall naturally off the tree, that's a sign that you better get there and harvest. I do not recommend harvesting after a frost. You try to get that done before a frost if possible.
All right.
Now, sometimes that isn't possible, and they go out, and if it's not too severe, they're okay. But sometimes what frost will do is it's that cold temperature damages the tissue, reducing its storage ability.
Steve is on the line now from Dubuque. Hello, Steve.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Enjoy the show very much.
Thanks.
I'd like to ask a question regarding a sycamore tree that's given me some worry. It's a 10 to 12-year-old tree. and it's growing in a pretty heavily clay soil. The last two summers, I've noticed the leaf production very limited and some dying smaller branches on it. I don't see any kind of insect infestation, or even the good leaves that do come out look very healthy. But the fact that I see the dying branches has me somewhat worried. Is there something that I can be doing to assist this recovery?
Steve, when you see the leaves dying, is it midsummer? Is it spring? When do you notice that?
This spring I was watching it closely because I saw some problems last year. This spring it seemed to be budding out good and fully, but then the actually lower branches are the ones that appeared to die and fall off, and then there was some more leaves coming in later in the summer. But a rather thin crown on it. So the dying that I saw was earlier in the year.
Yeah, sycamore are great trees. They get huge. I hope you're prepared for that because someday
I'm looking forward to it.
Someday this tree will be a monster, and they are the classic shedding organism. These things will shed things all the time. They shed branches and parts of their bark. But they have one chink in the armor. They are rather prone to a disease called anthracnose. And depending on the year, it can be very severe. And this year it was rather severe because of our wet, cool weather. So this disease causes the tree to lose its leaves early in the growing season. Keep in mind that the tree spends all this energy to leaf out. In comes the disease and causes a lot of the foliage to drop. And then generally the tree puts on a second crop of leaves and it carries on without too much to be concerned about. It sounds like your tree didn't respond as well, perhaps, to this disease as others that I've noticed. That's my best guess as to what you're seeing. The disease also can hang out on the branches and sometimes causes some branch dieback, and that also might be what you're seeing. Generally, the disease is nothing much to worry about. It's more of a cosmetic issue. I've seen large sycamore that have lived with this disease for decades, and they never seem to miss a beat. But it is disturbing when you see all the leaves falling off the tree in May or early June, but generally they're replaced by a new crop. Apparently, yours isn't quite responding the same way that most of them do.
And it's in a remote location, so I'm not able to be there to water it when it's dry or whatever. It merely survives on its own.
Sycamore are pretty tough trees. I wouldn't worry about the clay soil. They are floodplain trees. They're used to low oxygen soils, and so this is a tree. It sounds like it's established. I can't think of anything that I would do for it. I mean, you could limit weed growth around it to eliminate competition. You could water if you were so inclined, but we certainly haven't needed to do that this year.
If I mulched a perimeter around it, would that assist?
You could. I mean, I would like to mulch out to the tips of the branches, and that might be.
And that's at this point now. That's too much.
Yeah. So the tree sounds like it's on its own. I would watch it.
All right.
I can't think of anything that I would recommend that you do for it. Maybe some pruning if you see some pruning issues.
Okay.
But
may I ask another question regarding American chestnut?
Briefly, yes.
My father planted several. They were established from nuts gathered at the Trempealeau planting up in Trempealeau, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
They've been in the ground and producing nuts now for about 10 years.
Wow.
I try to harvest those nuts and get those to germinate. I've had some success. However, I compete with all the deer and the turkeys and the squirrels. I love them so much. Any suggestions on how to actually harvest the nuts in a proper manner to prevent the wildlife from eating them?
Well, that's a tough one. Netting might be something you do, but, boy, that's not going to be very practical for any length of time. I don't know how you would fight the animals unless you set up a tent out there and watch the trip. Linda, do you have any words of wisdom?
Well, you know, that's a tough call. Anytime you're dealing with wildlife, you know, sometimes they're smarter than the human species when it comes. They're more resilient, and it's a matter of life or death for them. But anyway, so I would suggest you contact. And you're not the only one that's had this problem with chestnuts. So what I would do is I would contact the Chestnut Association of America. I'm not sure if that's the title of their organization, but there's definitely an organization out there. And many of these organizations offer a lot of good educational material, a lot of it from the School of Hard Knocks, from other growers. So I would definitely go to that site.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Steve. If you have a question, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPRTalk. And we have an email from Tom in Johnston. He said that he had an oak leaf hydrangea that died branch by branch this summer. The leaves just wilted very quickly. Any ideas what this was? The site is shady. It faces the northwest and is in between a porch and some yew trees. Any suggestions for a replacement? He'd like something about the same size.
Yeah. Well, it's a great plant, and I'd hate to give up on it. I wonder if he's asking why it might have died. The first thing that comes to my mind is rabbit damage. We saw an awful lot of rabbit damage on a lot of plants, especially on hydrangea. And so when the rabbit girdles the stem, the plant will sometimes leaf out and look natural, but then it declines as stressful weather conditions appear. And so perhaps he has a rabbit problem. I like oak leaf hydrangea, and in Johnston it should do fine. So he might want to try that again. But rabbit protection is critical, especially when we have persistent snow cover like we did this past year. But there are just so many different kinds of plants out there that he could use in the shade. I like viburnums, so he might investigate those as well.
All right. And also we have another email. This is from Pam, and she wants to know if it's too late to reseed a damaged area in her yard and how she should go about it.
Lawn, I assume she's talking about?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. No, this is fine. In fact, I would get it done soon. In fact, I would get it done this morning. So I'd go out and rake the area and seed, and water, of course, is critical. You want to make sure the seeds don't dry out. But no, this is a good time to do that.
All right. And it sounds like the window is short. This weekend is the time to do
it. Yeah, I wouldn't want to go too much longer, although you never know what fall in Iowa is going to bring. But yeah, now would be the time.
All right. Randy's on the line from Iowa County. Hello, Randy.
Hi, I've got a pear that has a reddish cheek on the side, and I don't have a clue what it is. People have been telling me at Farmer's Market that it tastes a little bit like an apple.
Interesting. I can't answer that without you could send it in to somebody in the Hort Department. Dr. Nanaki, she might be able to identify it. Dr. DeMoto might be able to identify it. Or, better yet, we use technology. Take a picture of it, cut it open, show what it looks like so they get an idea of size, put a ruler next to it, and then I would just send it on to one of our fruit specialists, either Dr. DeMoto or Dr. Nanaki, and they'd be able to help you with that. But take a picture of it, email it in, and they'd get back to you.
When are you guys going to be at the Cedar Rapids Farmers Market this weekend? I'll be there with pears.
No, but the easiest thing is just take that picture, but make sure you take it next to a ruler or some judgment of size and describe maybe when it comes into production, because timing on harvest is important when you can to identify varieties too.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Randy. And if you have apple trees that you've inherited, if you buy a property and you don't know what kind they are, is that the same thing that you can do, or is there a guide that you could look at to try to figure out from what your apple looks like and tastes like?
Yeah, it's hard from a guide. Paul DeMoto, Dr. Paul DeMoto in our department, is the tree fruit specialist, and he gets all kinds of things in boxes this time of the year. So
he is excellent. Yeah, he can take a look at an apple, and he knows exactly what it is. It's amazing. And there are hundreds of apple varieties out there, some of the heirloom varieties that are now coming back into popularity. So, and he's a good expert.
All right.
Yeah.
It's clearly an art as well as a science.
I've seen him just hold the box up to his head like Karnak and without even seeing the fruit. It's amazing.
All right. If you have a question, call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, we have Mary in Des Moines. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a problem this year that I've never had before. I have a small garden, And usually the ground is very loamy and loose, you know, easy to work with. This year, no matter when I went out to plant, spring, summer, even now, when I dig it, it's clumpy and the clumps won't break up. Is there something I can do this fall or next spring to prevent that?
Well, it sounds, did you, by any chance, when you went out to start your garden, was it a little wet when you first cultivated it with the rototiller?
Parts of it were, but I didn't do it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it was, when I thought it should be dry, I still had the same problem.
We had a heck of a summer. Where did you say you were from?
Des Moines.
When we got so much rain, but early in the spring, we always encourage gardeners to do the hand grasp, form a ball test. In other words, mm-hmm. go out to your garden in the spring and take a handful of soil. And if that handful of soil with a little pressure crumbles, it's a great stage to work your garden. It has a little field moisture in it, but not too wet. But if it forms a tight ball that doesn't break and crumble easily, it's too wet to work. And what happens when gardeners get over anxious, or even farmers for that matter, they form large clods and are fine seeded crops, and those large clods just don't go away very easily. You can try to rototill, but then again, you destroy the soil structure when you try to just pulverize those clods. So you really cause some damage for the entire season. And many of our garden crops are temperamental, fine seeded. Our transplants don't like those large clods because the water is held tightly in them, or it moves on through between the clods. So But what I would do this fall, clear off your garden when you go and rototill it. Again, this fall, when you find a dry moment in time between rainstorms, which would be pretty good now if your garden's gone, and rototill it this fall, and then make sure you check next spring and don't work it when it's too wet.
Okay.
All right. Good luck with that, Mary. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Dan is on the line in Waukee. Hello, Dan.
Hi, this is Dan. Hey. I've got a blaze maple. I think it's on its third season of, you know, pretty good diameter. It does well most of the year, but this time of the year, instead of turning that brilliant color that you would expect, it seems like it turns brown and gets crunchy and drops leaves pretty quickly.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a lot on autumn blaze maple, Dan. I don't know. I think our fall color this year is not going to be what we normally look for. It's been a strange year, and I think a lot of trees are just giving it up early. But I've seen autumn blaze maple do this, and it's kind of spotty in the landscape, and I don't have a good answer for it. Is your tree mulched? Is it in the yard? Can you describe?
Yeah, it's in a new property, yeah. And that part of the yard does not drain well.
Okay.
And you know, and what it appears is there's clay for the first maybe 10 inches, and then you get down to black dirt underneath that.
Yeah.
The two Cleveland pears on each side do great. It just seems like it's a little more thirsty.
Yeah. Well, this tree is one that should handle clay soils, and its relatives are from the floodplain, so it should do well there. But we see an awful lot of trees planted a little bit too deep in those clay soils, too, and that might be having a factor here. So I can't think of anything you could do for the plant, though. Hopefully it'll eventually straighten itself out. They are very popular trees, and they've done very well for us here in central Iowa.
Super. And then you were saying something about lilacs. When's the best time to prune them back?
I'm a big fan of doing that in mid-March. You know, the leaves are gone. You can see the plant's architecture. I like that late dormant season.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And a final question today. This is from Leah in Ames. She says, I bought an old home recently, and there are not a lot of mature trees on the property. I recently realized that many of the trees we have are actually buckthorn, which I understand is considered to be a noxious species. I have no attachment to the shrubby ones, but some of them are actually relatively large trees. I hate to cut them down because that would leave my yard pretty bare. Am I a bad citizen if I leave the large ones alone?
Yes.
Okay. What's the deal with buckthorns?
No, Leah's a fantastic citizen.
Okay.
I'm sure she is. Well, but if you leave them there, they produce fruit. The birds are going to scatter them around. Buckthorn are a problem, and they're shade tolerant. They get into natural areas, And I know there are some folks in town that are on a crusade to eradicate this plant. So, I'd hate to be a repository for buckthorn in my yard. You might have people marching on your house. So
maybe you can get your neighbors to take up a collection to buy you some nice shade trees.
That's right.
All right. Well, good luck, Leah. Thank you so much for your calls and questions today. Jeff Iles, thank you.
Great to be here.
Jeff Iles is the head of the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. And Linda Nave, thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
From Iowa State University Extension. We'll have Horticulture Day again next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on Talk of Iowa, alternative sports such as disc golf. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.